the law that we use is based on the 1872 Ballot Act. And I think the standing thing is if Queen Victoria were alive today and walked into a polling station, she'd recognise most of what's going on. A stubby pencil and a piece of paper with a tin ballot box sort of thing.
The full and free exercise of our sacred right and duty to vote is more important in the long run than the personal hopes or ambitions of any candidate for any office in the land.
You're listening to High Turnout, Wide Margins, an insider's look at election administration hosted by Brianna Lennon and Eric Fay.
Welcome to another exciting episode of High Turnout, Wide Margins. This is Brianna Lennon. I am the county clerk for Boone County, and with me is my co-host,
Eric Fay, Director of Elections in St. Louis County, Missouri.
And today we are exploring another international elections episode, and with us is
Peter Stanion, Chief Executive of the Association of Electoral Administrators in the UK.
You know, we always ask our guests the first questions is how you end up working in elections. So what was your pathway to getting involved?
I think as with most electoral administrators in the UK, I fell into elections because they're tied into local authorities in Great Britain. It's a function undertaken within the council effectively. And I just happened to be there when a vacancy appeared. And as with most electoral administrators, once you've got that bug, you can't get rid of it. And 34 years later, here I am still delivering on the electoral side of things. So there was no plan. There was no from our primary schools all the way through to university. It was very much a case of, you could almost say right place, wrong time in some respects at times. But no, that's how I ended up into it. Fell into the job and love it even today.
So, Peter, could you take a couple minutes and explain to the Americans in the audience, at least, in broad strokes, the structure of election administration in the UK?
Yeah, it's quite a unique structure. We do have an electoral commission in the UK. That was came into being in the year 2000, but they're an advisory body, principally. So elections themselves, very historically set up back in Victorian times on the basis of the local authorities across the whole of the UK. There's in the region just shy of 400 local authorities, and each of those has to appoint a returning officer for elections and an electoral registration officer for the registration side of things. And then effectively the elections are run at that level with, so if we take, for example, the forthcoming parliamentary general election, whenever that may be called, it will be called by Parliament, and then it's run by the local authority structures underneath that, before returning the members of Parliament to the House. So everything is done at that lower level of government administration, being led by the law that's written, obviously, by House of Commons, House of Lords, UK Parliament.
Peter, could you talk a little bit about if there is a typical election office in the UK? I mean, do they work full time in the capacity of administering elections in the electoral, the voters' role? Do they normally have employees that work for them full time, or what? What is the typical office in the UK look like?
Typical office. I don't think we can define a typical office because it will vary from area to area. You've got the range of, if you take a London authority, for example, much larger authorities, you will have typically a team of four or five administrators solely concerned with electoral registration and elections. The manager themselves may well be actually have other responsibilities. I, for example, have about five or six different areas of responsibility, including elections, solely because it's a way of actually paying more money to those to stay with the authorities. There's very much a shortage of key staff. But in smaller authorities, you may well have other roles taken on board as well. You will always have somebody who is there specifically responsible for the administration of the electoral process, and that is one of the big areas at the moment that our local authorities, although they're very, very cash-strapped going forwards, are very, very conscious of the changes coming through that makes it more of an electoral registration process all the way through into beyond polling day itself. As far as the support is concerned, all of the polling station staff, the counting staff, those who do with postal voting, will all be brought in on a temporary basis per election. So, again, typically, if I take my background, my 100 polling stations, I'm talking 500-600 staff solely employed for one day to do that type, with all the training, the recruitment, the like to go ahead of that. So there is no such thing as typical, but effectively there will always be, in every single UK authority, local authority, a core of those who've got the experience and the expertise. And then that is actually built up as we go forwards with the volunteers coming in to provide the actual delivery mechanisms on polling day in advance to polling day itself.
So, Peter, talk a little bit about the role your organization plays in assisting administrators in the UK. You know, in the United States, we have associations on the state level in almost every state, and then we have a couple nationwide associations of election administrators. And, you know, things are done so differently across the states in the United States. And I assume there, because your elections are run on local level, I assume, you know, because of different sizes, different, you know, rural and urban and things like that, you see somewhat of the same thing. So tell folks a little bit about the AEA and what role that plays in things like implementing photo ID and other administrative processes.
Yeah, the association was actually set up in 1987, a year before I actually joined Electoral Services. So I'm one of the longer term members of the association. It was set up because effectively, as will be the case for many of your listeners, the law book governs how you run elections. If it's either yes or it's no, and there are those grey areas. There was nothing before the association was set up. It was local government officers who thought, we just need to start showing good practice. We need to start talking about how would you deal with a situation in, as you say, an urban area, a rural area, whatever the case may well be, recognising that each individual team is responsible for delivering to the rules in the book, effectively. It's developed since then, so we predate the Electoral Commission by 13 years, but we work very closely with them. The role of the AEA is really no different to what it was in those early days. It's about, if we just take, for example, our training, we deliver all the training in the UK for electoral administrators, except for that that's delivered by the electoral management software systems on their own individual systems. But the training is primarily delivered by people who deliver elections. So there's a very much an understanding of what the practical implications are alongside the theoretical way that elections should be run. So we're in a very good position as far as trying to ensure that good practice, have you tried this, you might want to try that, is rolled out. So that's where the value comes into that. We're not the same organisation we were when we got set up. We're very much now, we're not a lobbying organisation, but we are the critical friends, we believe, of governments across the UK to actually point out the pros and cons and how do you deliver policy change within polling stations, within offices, how will it affect electors as much as it will affect administrators trying to deliver. So if you take the voter ID situation as a good example, a lot of the work that we did was about the flows within polling station. How do you make sure you're recording the data that government and the Electoral Commission want to actually analyse how successful or not the system has been? How does that impinge on the actual delivery of the election? Because sometimes the new policy overrides everything and you forget you've got an election to run. The election hasn't changed since 1872, a lot of the procedures that we've got. But all the morphing on top of that, the layering, that's where we can come in and actually advise both governments in terms of what the risks are and what the mitigations may well then be. But also it's talking about administrators, about how can they almost get through this process. We've got a huge amount of change coming with the Elections Act 2022 that's rolling out now. It's not just voter ID. There's lots of other anti-fraud measures in there. There's a whole layering, as I've talked about, of change that's coming through. We are working very closely with administrators, taking good practice, good ideas, how do we get this working in reality so that ultimately I, as a voter walking through the door, can show my ID, will be able to put my ballot paper in the box in the normal way I would do so without any of the issues that could potentially be there had we not worked through those things. So very much a practical organisation in terms of actually, one, making sure the policy is deliverable in the main, but secondly, how can we make that better for those who are the people who actually push the buttons, move the paper around, arrange all the arrangements that need to be done in that way. So very practical, hands-on type of organisation.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, I know you alluded to the fact that the photo ID part was pretty controversial. What do you think, has there been a precipitating event, or is it, do you think, more of the international conversation regarding fraud? What do you think has been driving a lot of the push for reform?
Yeah, well, the narrative's changed in the last year. It was only in May of last year that photo ID was required at polling stations. Now, in the UK, we don't have things such as national identity cards. It's very much a mishmash of the ID that can be presented. Primarily, it was passports, it was photo driving licenses, and older persons' bus passes. But there are 22 different forms of ID that can potentially be shown at polling stations themselves. I think we can go back to one particular local authority in London where there was some significant issues with regards to electoral fraud, primarily driven by candidates and parties, not by the administration of the process. That authority is Tower Hamlets, which is in close to the City of London. Following that incident around 15, 20 years ago, I think from memory now, a report was produced by the Secretary of State at the time, but now Lord Eric Pickles, that highlighted a number of issues around potential fraud opportunities within UK electoral law. Very much a trust-based system, has always been a trust-based system, but because of a number of factors, that trust was being was leaning more to the potential for fraud coming in. There was actual fraud, there were cases. In fact, the mayor of that particular borough was debarred from office for 5 years because of the instances that took place. That report was informing, but that's formed the basis of all of the Elections Act changes that are coming through. Whether they are still relevant, whether it's more a perception rather than it being an actual case taking place, is the debate that's going on. So taking voter ID is a really good example. The perception was that personation, as it's known in the UK, took place in polling stations. Very, very few recorded cases. But then you could also argue the counter-argument, which says, well, it may well be that they're not being picked up at the station rather than not being reported in that way. So there's certainly the perception of fraud was raised within the decision-makers' minds. And from that, the intention was then to bring in the voter ID to take that away. We can map it all the way back to things like postal voting, where the original system that was rolled out was, again, trust-based. Because actual fraud took place in a couple of areas in the UK, not across the whole board, but in a couple of areas, additional security measures had to be introduced to ensure that actually that perception was taken away in those areas. So I've used that word quite a lot, perception. It's huge changes, but I think it is arguable whether the actual evidence is there to confirm that the actual outcome would have been the outcome without the actual report and the views taken by one particular Member of Parliament at the time who was doing that investigation back in Tower Hamlets.
Hi, I'm Brianna Lennon, County Clerk for Boone County, Missouri, and you are listening to High Turnout, Wide Margins, a podcast where we explore local election administration.
Peter, what role, if any, do the membership of your organization have in crafting these policies? The commission, the election commission, or Parliament, do they consult with your membership when they're crafting these policies and laws?
I think it's fair to say yes and no. We're not, our members are not policy making body. There are views, and we have certainly got on the record several areas where we believe that government, whoever that may well be, take forward change. It's a very high level one that's been around for a while. Whereas I think I made reference to earlier, the law that we use is based on the 1872 Ballot Act. And I think the standing thing is if Queen Victoria were alive today and walked into a polling station, she'd recognise most of what's going on. A stubby pencil and a piece of paper with a tin ballot box sort of thing. But there's nothing wrong with that. But the Law Commission's actually said a number of changes need to take place. They did their report six, 7 years ago now, and it's never gone anywhere. So a lot of the things that we will be pressing for change on are more around the granular parts of the process, not should there be voter ID, not should there be more things around postal voting. When it comes to the actual, when a government has made its decision on policy, we then get involved. We are very fortunate to be at the table where often they will show us the draft secondary legislation, the draft primary legislation. We will go through and actually flag up, we identify issues here, how about this, alternative options. But ultimately, it would then be for the government and their civil servants to determine what the actual legislation says. We don't always get on or agree, I should say. We often have very heated disagreements about the way policy is rolled out. But ultimately, that's what governments are there for. We're there more about how does that deliver going forward. So in terms of incoming administrations, it varies. So as I say, there's a general election coming up. If there's a change in government, we may well get spoken to before the actual election to say, we're thinking of doing this. What? How can we make that work? But that's very much down to the political masters, should we say, within those parties as to how they want to flesh out their policy, their ideas going forwards in terms of their manifestos and that. So we are very much involved in the detail to make sure that it is practical to work going forwards.
I feel like I would be very remiss, since you just said that the process is a piece of paper and a pencil in a box. How do you do counting of the ballots in the UK, and have there been conversations about changing it?
There's often conversations about changing it. In fact, we've gone the opposite way. In London, the mayoral and wider constituency elections, until this year coming, were counted through optical voting machines. So there were three contests. So they're still marked by pencil onto a ballot paper, but they were counted through scanners. But that's now changed because the system has gone back to a first-past-the-post system rather than the proportional system that was there previous. That, again, was part of the Elections Act. How do we do it? It's dead easy. You've got a piece of paper, you sort it into the right piles, and then you come up with results. So it's all done in centralised locations. It's not done in individual polling stations. So my background, when I worked at a local authority, I had in the region of 100 polling stations. They'd all come back to a central location. You balance the figures to make sure what you've got back is what you're expecting back with the verification process. And a straightforward sort. And there are lots of different ways of counting, depending on whether it's there's very simple elections in terms of a first past the post, one vacancy is just sorting between the candidates. That's dead easy. Where you're electing 3 from 12, for example, there are a number of different methods that are used, but they're all very transparent. They're all very tried and tested. And within, I would say, in most instances, 4 hours to close a poll, you've got a set of results. So it's quite an efficient way of doing it as well. Generally done overnight. It can be held back to following day, but it's a very, very simple process of and quite a safe process. Has it? One of the big areas of contention at the moment is interference with elections. One of the advantages of the UK system, because it's a piece of, by the time you get to a polling station, it's a piece of paper, a pencil, and it's very difficult to tamper with that vote, unless you've got corrupt staff, for example. But if you're dealing with the actual outside interference, very difficult. If we were to bring in something like electronic voting or electronic counting or something along those lines, there's a greater chance of there being that interference. I think at the current stage, because of the levels of mistrust in terms of the electronic controls and things, we're further away from modernising that side of the process than we have been for quite some time. Because again, those members of parliament, those local councillors, they all know what a piece of paper and a pencil looks like, and they're able to then see very clearly in front of them. It's an open, transparent, fair system going forwards. You can recount. It's all there in front of you without having to tamper or go into code and things like that, which is the worry, I think, that many of the decision makers have got going forwards.
It is amazing to me, I guess, from an American perspective, the level of trust that exists in your system. And a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to observe the parliamentary election in Sweden. And I would say it was a relatively similar dynamic there, where these nonpartisan administrators, you know, from the local administration were running elections. You know, we have more of an adversarial structure, I suppose, in the United States. So yeah, that's fascinating to hear. Back to the point about the increased duties of the poll staff, and I assume that translates also to the full-time administrators. In the United States, especially since the 2020 election, there's been a large turnover. For example, in Missouri, about a third of our county election administrators are new in their positions. Is that a similar dynamic in the UK? Have you seen more turnover? And you know, we don't have a solution to it, but if you are seeing more turnover, have you all started talking about how you might remedy that?
I think it is the same. I think that's partly one of the unfortunate fallouts from the Elections Act and the principle behind that, which I referred to earlier, in terms of the perception of fraud is coming in rather than being actual fraud. And that has put greater pressure on administrators, certainly in some of those key areas. In terms of turnover of administrators, yeah, we've seen significant numbers now. Higher numbers over the last couple of years than previously, solely because in some respects the brute question is, if I've got the chance of taking early retirement or running a system that's hugely complex and can bring adversarial elements into it, what am I going to do? So a lot of the, probably completely the wrong terminology, but the older generation, the older breed, have begun to leave the profession. The danger with that is the experience of running elections is seeping out the system as well. So if we take the challenges ahead for the 2nd of May, which is the huge elections in England and Wales, and then the parliamentary general election at some stage, which will be called at 25 days notice. That's all they have, 5 weeks to set up the whole system. It's not so much the change that's coming, because very competent administrators can deal with change and can deal with what the process should be. But it goes back to the formation of the AEA in a lot of respects. It's about how it should be, but how can we make that, you know, Section A, Section B and Section C all work in tangent? A more experienced individual can do that because they, you know, back in such and such, we did this and worked this round. When you're dealing with very much a case of having to read what the law says and deliver it without that background experience, it makes life a lot more difficult. That's a huge risk. It's a risk that, again, is well recognised, and every mitigation under the sun is being considered, you know, trying to make it more of a, what resource can you build around the core teams? But ultimately, an electoral services manager in a local authority is more important than the returning officer, because they're doing the job 24/7. They understand the law. They know what the process is. They have to be protected. The returning officer has their name and all of the notices, and they've got that responsibility, but they've also got their other job in terms of running the local authority. So to me, there is no answer. And if I had the answer, I'd be willing to share that with you. The saving grace, I suppose, is there's always someone on the end of a phone. There's always someone on the end of an email, a Zoom call, whatever it might well be, solely to be able to turn around and say, I've got this problem, how do I deal with that? So, but that's not the answer to it, but that's part of the solution going forward. So very similar, but certainly not as adversarial as a you know, far-flung observer to the 2020 elections and the fallout from that. I electoral administrators in the US have my utmost sympathy with the pressure that was being layered onto them. But it's something that's starting to come in a little bit more in the UK, solely because it's such an important, well, it's such a strange time politically, I think is probably the best way of describing that.
Do you think any of that will have an impact on the short amount of time that they have notice for to have an election? Because, like, you, if somebody said that to a county clerk here, I think they would freak out if they said, you know, you got less than a month to figure all of this out. And granted, yes, you know how to put the election together, but we're used to having more like 15, 16 weeks to get everything situated. With new people coming in, do you think they're going to ask for more time?
I have to say, I think it'll be the opposite. It was only 2 years ago that there was a debate in Parliament about reducing the timetable back to 17 working days, not the 25 working days. Because it's to do with politics. It's to do with the fact that we can get our message in much, much more focused in a shorter period. The expenses of running elections, if you reduce the amount of time, it means the same budget can fund a lot more higher profile campaigning. We successfully fought that one back because the system, it used to be 17 working days. Then postal voting on demand was introduced. We had rolling registration introduced. We've had voter ID now introduced. A big change to the system. The debate when it took place was talking about a system back in the 1980s. And yes, you could do it then. You can't do it now. There is absolutely no appetite at all. In fact, as an organisation, we've been calling for a minimum 30-day election and we'll be laughed out of court. The changes that are coming through on that Victorian system that I talked about, without the, you know, lots of things have come in terms of all the modernisation that's taking place in registration to make it easier to register, easier to get yourself in position to cast your ballot, to enfranchise you, but nothing's being helped in terms of the actual voting process.
I know we're getting short on time, but Peter, you mentioned the digitization of some voter registration and, you know, online requests for postal ballots and so forth. Of course, in the United States, especially since 2016, there has been a lot of concern around election interference from foreign entities, persons, hacking election websites, election servers, things like that. Has that been a focus for you all as well?
It has. It's a growing focus, primarily because of the routes in now. The register to vote route, the absent voting online route, is all a government-led system, a government portal. And we have the assurances that, and I would expect the expectations, that they will be very, very robust. In fact, the cybersecurity experts are all over that as far as those systems are concerned. There's potential risk with regards to transfer of data between a returning officer and their print supplier and things like that, that is a minor risk, I would suggest, because it's still a paper-based system. I think the greater risk is more around the misinformation, AI coming into things about the messages going out to voters rather than the actual system itself. The one worrying time, I suppose, for administrators is around 11, 12 days out from the poll when all of the deadlines occur for registering to vote, absent voting and the like. Ironically, when you get to polling day, if a system was hacked, it wouldn't make a great deal of difference because it's all on piece of paper, all piece with little pencils, all out in the community. So you've got a pretty safe system when it comes to that side, which would be put at risk if it was if technology came in more to online voting or whatever the case may be. So, yeah, they're all over it. There are risks, but the two biggest single risks are the government portal. You have to rely on the government security advisors to have that actually nailed down in terms of the routes into local authorities, and on the potential misinformation, which would affect how votes are cast, not the actual mechanism of casting those votes, but very, very similar, rolling on the back of the last presidential elections as a result of the assertions being made at that time.
Brandon, you have anything else?
I got all my questions answered. I really appreciate it. This has been really fun.
Yeah.
You've been listening to High Turnout Wide Margins, a podcast that explores local elections administration. I'm your host, Brianna Lennon, alongside Eric Fay. A big thanks to KBIA and the Election Center for making this podcast possible. Our managing editor is Rebecca Smith. Managing producer is Aaron Hay. Our associate producer is Katie Quinn, and our digital producer is Mark Johnson. This has been High Turnout Wide Margins. Thanks for listening.